Welcome to Disruptive Successor, a show for next generation leaders in family businesses and entrepreneurs who want to disrupt the status quo and take their existing business to a whole new level. We all know that what got us here isn't going to get us there. This show will provide inspiration, advice, and resources to help you create massive impact. This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, The Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at thegoldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session. Hi, it's Jonathan Goldhill, and welcome back to another episode of the Disruptive Successor Show. Today, my guest is Ashley Walters, a business executive with a proven track record of leading transformational change. During the past 20 years, she led the turnaround of a 50-year-old industrial furnace manufacturing and service company, a family business owned by her husband's family based out of Erie, Pennsylvania. During her last 10 years with the company, she became president of Onyx, where she led the effort to turn the company into an employee-owned ESOP business, which we're going to talk about today during the show. Part of the key to Ashley's success is her coach approach leadership style, which is very different than the traditional command and control leadership you typically see in manufacturing companies. She left the company in December 2022 to become chairperson of the company. But this was 2 years after she launched her book, Leading with Grit and Grace, and private consulting practice. She regularly shares her story with other leaders, encouraging them to make things better by improving processes and creating a people-centric organizational culture. You can read all about how she made things better in her new book, which we will discuss also on the show today. Ashley, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, you've had some life changes. You moved out of Erie, Pennsylvania, I take it, and moved into Knoxville, Tennessee. It's a new chapter, really exciting, and we'll get into talking about what you're up to today at the end of the show. But I really want to talk about Onyx, which was originally owned by your husband, Drew, and his family. And how did you end up there, first of all? Like, what took you to that company?
Yeah. So everybody thinks I started my career as like the GM and president of the company in 2013, but that wasn't actually the case. I really started with the company in 2003 in technical sales. I got a position in their pulp and paper technical sales department. We were installing chain systems in lime kilns across the Southeast at the time. And so that's where my roots were in the business. And in 2009, Drew and I had our first little one, and the baby decided to come 6 weeks early. So I went from a working mom to a stay-at-home mom literally overnight. And I was at home with two little boys. They were 2 and 3 at the time when my father-in-law called in 2013. And he said, the CFO has left the company. He said, I just generally need you to look at the financials and lead. And I'll tell you, my father-in-law is a great salesman. He told me it was going to be a part-time job. And it was not a part-time job. His definition and mine are very different. So there I was in Charlotte, North Carolina with Drew and the kids. And we had to really think about this, right? This wasn't supposed to happen until the boys went to school and I was able to return to the workforce. But what we found was that the company was in a dire financial situation. And we knew that we had 50 families depending upon us as a family to get this right. And to make it better and to fix it and to do it quickly. So we made that decision to ultimately move to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and then on to Erie, Pennsylvania, and really help reshape that business. I call it a remodeling project of a 50-year company.
Yeah. So not a gut renovation, a remodel.
It was a remodel. We just needed a redo. The foundation was a little broken, and so we needed to get on more stable ground. But overall, we had a good team in place. We just needed to start working together again. The previous general manager and CFO had siloed everybody. He came in with a very command and control style leadership. And to my father-in-law's credit, he knew that we were a growing company and we needed processes and systems. Very true with most growing companies.
Sure.
What we didn't need was a change in our core value, change in leadership style. And that's where we lost our way. So if you've ever had somebody that broke your trust, if they ever can repair it, it takes a long time. And that's kind of the situation we found ourselves in, was we had to regain and repair that trust of the employees and let them know that we were there for them and we were going to make it right, that we'd made a mistake.
That's amazing. Tell us about your ascension to the presidency. How did that come about?
Yeah, so I started out as the general manager, and my first task was implementing a new accounting system because the numbers we were getting were just junk. I think DOS-based green screens is what we were in, right? 1980s accounting system. And so once we found like the numbers, we knew what we were managing, that we did make a lot of structural changes. We divested of two product lines that were failing. We moved the plant across town because the overhead was too much in the other location. But one of the things that I did that made the difference was change that leadership style. And it took time, but I wanted a more democratic leadership style. And one of the things that led me to that was that I knew that I didn't know everything, right? And I could say that. I could say, I don't know, but I can get the resources or I can figure out how we're going to get to that next level. So I would sit with people and I would say, what frustrates you? What takes up the most of your time? And we really started getting those inefficiencies out of the business. And I was removing obstacles for them. I was helping them accomplish their own goals. And as I helped them, they helped me. And that's how we rebuilt that team.
That's great. I always recommend that a CEO walk around, have conversations with people. Like, what should we start doing? What should we stop doing? And what should we keep or continue doing? And that sounds like that type of conversation. It was very powerful. And how quickly let's just talk about you being a woman in a manufacturing business in a very, not only command and control style, but like a heavy duty manufacturing company. How quickly did people embrace you as a woman in a leadership role?
Yeah, it wasn't even the woman. It was a daughter-in-law. So I had an added layer there. You know what? Everybody has always been really kind to me for the most part. There's always like your naysayers.
Yeah.
But my father-in-law and my husband were huge advocates of mine, as well as one of our board members, all three male. I think because I had that advocacy and those allies that others said, okay, like she must know something, right?
Yep.
They believe in her. So I will too believe in her.
And so your father-in-law chose you over his son and other siblings?
Yeah. So Drew does have two brothers. They haven't been involved in the family business. They worked in the family business when they were kiddos or teenagers, but they weren't involved in the family business at the time. And it was actually Drew's choice to have me as president. Drew loves sales. He loves being with the clients. He loves solving problems for them. And he knew that it would take away from that if he was the leader of the company. He needed to be back with operations and helping the people do what they need to do.
Yeah.
So it was really his voice.
That's great. I've had clients who were basically led their business and very successfully to $20 million plus companies. And they were primarily just a salesperson who loved schmoozing with customers. And because they didn't have anyone in the CEO or COO seat, that they fell into it, but they didn't enjoy that part of the business. So it sounds like you really relished that opportunity.
Yeah, I enjoyed that opportunity, but Drew wouldn't have enjoyed it as much because it would have taken away from his primary passion.
Yep. All right. So let's talk about the transformation to becoming an ESOP. What was the thinking behind that? When did that process start? Walk us through that, like chronologically, maybe if you can remember that far back.
Yeah. So in 2018, Drew and I purchased all of his father's shares. So we became 100% owners between the two of us. But that transition took a long time. It started in 2014. And it started with meetings of the minds when it came to transition planning and exit planning. We just could not find a way to transition the company in a way that his parents needed us to, because they were at retirement age and they needed to retire. And as a small business, you have pretty much everything you have plugged into a small business. And when you go to retire, you need it out.
Yep.
So Drew and I ultimately purchased the shares with after-tax dollars, which is not ideal, a family member.
After evaluation, I assume, right?
After evaluation.
Yep. Right. Okay.
So the company was valued and we ended up purchasing with after-tax dollars. Drew's father was kind enough to hold a seller's note for us that we got to pay or could pay over the course of 10 years.
Was that a large piece of the business? What, can you give us an idea what percent did he carry back?
So I don't remember specifically. I think Drew already owns 25% of the business. So
okay.
We were purchasing 75.
Okay.
It was between 50 and 75. I don't remember that detail for sure.
Okay.
So as luck would have it, in 2019, I was sitting on a succession planning panel and I was sitting there as the first generation to second generation transition. And the keynote for that day was Kevin McPhillips from the Pennsylvania Center of Employee Ownership. And he talked all about employee ownership. And I went to him at lunch that day and I said, wow, this is an incredible model. Like, I want to learn more. And I want to know, what does Onyx have to look like in order for this to be possible for us? And so we had a quick conversation and he goes, Ashley, if you're not there, you're really close.
Mm.
He said, that was just a high level feasibility study done. Mm. So I went home that day and I told Drew all about an ESOP.
Yep.
Everything I learned. And he said, you're crazy. That's not right. Like, you misheard. And so we watched every YouTube video we could find on it over the weekend. And he goes, no, I think you actually heard correctly. And we had a high level feasibility study done at the end of 2019 and started like preparing for that transition in 2020.
Can you tell us a little bit about what is involved in a feasibility study with an ESOP and maybe what were some of those requirements? Do you remember back?
It was just really, I would say most companies are somewhere in that like $10 million revenue range plus somewhere around $1 million EBITDA.
Okay.
When it starts to make sense.
Okay. I thought it was 2 million EBITDA, but okay. That sounds good to me. But
and it depends upon the company too, right? There's so many factors. I'd say in the ESOP world, there are so many professionals out there, like,
yep,
they can hold your hand and guide the way.
Yep.
But yeah, so in 2020, we made this decision early on, like, this looks like a go. It sounds like a great plan. And the way that an ESOP works is that you are no longer taxed on the income of the business. So as an S Corp, which is what we were, the income from the business was flowing through onto mine and Drew's personal.
Right.
So when you're no longer taxed, that tax savings on the income is what actually goes to pay out the sellers. That's where the money comes from to pay the sellers for their shares. And you're only not taxed on the percent of the stock that's in the employee ownership of trust. So for us, we decided to go 100%, but you can go really any percentage.
Okay.
We told our management team, because we're a relatively small company, 50 employees, and we know how the rumor mill goes. And so we wanted the management team to be in on it. We didn't want the rumor mill to be that we were selling the company.
Was that part of the feasibility study for the consultants to come in and talk to employees and find out maybe their capacity to own it, run it, comprehend it?
More in the due diligence.
Okay.
So the due diligence is very much what you would go through if you were selling to a private equity or third party, very similar, maybe even more stringent, because the ESOPs are governed by the Department of Labor.
Right? Okay.
So lots of checks and balances. No, I actually had Kevin McPhillips come back in to Onyx and explain to the management team, what is an ESOP and what does this mean? And he did a phenomenal job. And then we got started on the process and then the pandemic hit.
Oh boy.
Literally 1 week later. And so anyway, we said it made good business sense in February. It still makes good business sense today. We're going to plug ahead. We had a few hiccups along the way just because of the pandemic, but overall the process took, we started in March and we closed July 15th.
Amazing.
So
pretty fast close.
Pretty fast.
So the employees have to come up with nothing. Right?
Nothing. They come up with nothing. Yeah. And
they fund the purchase of the business through the tax savings. Is that how I understand it?
Yeah. So there are ESOP like friendly banks out there that understand the ESOP world, and they will lend what they would call a tranche. The sellers usually do not get the whole amount in that first tranche, right? And then there's seller's notes. So much like my father-in-law did, we held seller's notes. And it's meant to be a long-term buyout in most cases, somewhere between 5 and 10 years. But our employees were so successful, they bought us out in 2.5.
Unbelievable. Amazing. Wow. Yep. And 100% they bought you out.
100% they bought us out.
That seems unusual. I had a prior guest just a few weeks ago, a few episodes ago, talking about their ESOP. And they presented some their experience, which is very different from your experience.
It was a little different. I got to hear that episode. So I think what I can say is all ESOP experiences are different.
Okay.
But so your previous guest had talked about how they received only a third of the value that they would have gotten in the market. That wasn't the case for us. We got a fair market value. When they do the valuation of the company, it's much like just a normal valuation would be done in your private equity or third party sales. They look, it's ultimately for ESOP, it's a little different in that they look 5 years into the future. So you're asked to forecast into the future instead of where a traditional sale would be 3 to 5 years rear looking, right? So it is the discounted cash flow method. And we got fair market value for the company. Now, was it the same that we would have gotten out of private equity or a third party strategic sale? No, but it was definitely fair market value.
Was that a consideration? What would we get from a PE firm or a strategic buyer, and if we could make a lot more money? What was the thinking, the backstory there?
So for us, we're in manufacturing, and we have seen so many private equity sales of these family-owned businesses, and we felt very strongly that we wanted to make sure that the business remained in the Erie community for many generations to come. So we were, I would say, somewhat fearful of a private equity sale and that they wouldn't keep the business in the local area. So that was definitely one of the considerations. We also had embedded basis from Drew's father that he wasn't able to take, and we needed a stock sale in order to be able to get that embedded basis. So as most third-party private equity sales would be asset-based, and so that embedded basis would be lost. So those were probably the two highest level reasons that we chose ESOP. But I would say the number one reason that we chose ESOP is because we were rewarding the people who are doing the work.
I want to get into that. I don't understand the concept of embedded basis. I understand of stock versus an asset sale. I think most people are listening probably understand the distinction. But can you explain what you mean by Drew's dad had an embedded basis in the company that he would not have gotten out?
So when he bought out previous stockholder paid a higher amount than the company was valued at when we purchased.
Understand.
So that got embedded and you can't transfer it. You have to transfer it to the next generation when you sell in a family. If he had sold to a third party, then he would have been able to take the embedded basis. But because it was a family sale, it had to transfer.
Okay. I want to get onto the story of, I have some questions around employee engagement before and after the sale, and if you measure it and maybe what you discovered. Why don't we just get into that? Because I can't remember the other question I was going to ask. So do you measure employee engagement at the company, or anecdotally, can you share, what do you think the engagement was like before and after?
We have measured employee engagement, but it was just in this last year in 2022. So I don't have a benchmark prior to that.
Okay.
But I can tell you, our employees became more engaged throughout the whole kind of cultural transformation process, right? We really were leading in that democratic coach approach, leadership style. We all knew we had a responsibility for continuous improvement. And I think those two things are very important. And then ESOP, you can read plenty of stories about failures of ESOPs and all, but I think that culture piece is really important because now you have owners in the company, right? And so what happened was they just had a stronger engagement once they became owners. They took even more pride and responsibility and wanted to make things better. And they wanted to learn more about the business and how they could impact different pieces of it. But the other thing that happened is we started seeing what I'll call policing within the employees. And so if you were doing what they felt like you should be doing, we're told to pick up the pace, right? We're all owners. Yep. We're in this together.
Yep.
And if you're not going to pick up the pace, get out of here. So that was a phenomenon that we dealt with that first year.
Interesting. And what about financial literacy? Was that something that you had to engage in? Like in the Great Game of Business, they teach you, like, people need to understand the P&L and the balance sheet. And there's some great stories around that in that Great Game of Business story with Jack Stack and employees on the shop floor asking questions about the AR, AP turnover, inventory turnover. You know, what did that look like inside of your company, or what does it look like to do?
I would say we're at the very beginning stages. Like, you're not just going to hand somebody off the shop floor a P&L or a balance sheet and then have any idea what's going on. So what we did was we hired a consultant to come in and play what he called the ESOP game. His name is Jim Bado. And he was able to teach them the difference between giving a raise versus giving a bonus versus replacing a piece of machinery versus doing maintenance on machinery, right? Had all these different choices that you have to make. And as a business owner, we had to make these choices, right? We only have so much cash. How are you going to deploy it? And so he would allow them to make the decisions, and he would value their company at the end of that round of decision making.
Interesting.
Up or down.
Right.
And so then they started to catch on, like, how their decisions were affecting this fault, this made up company that he had. Then he would also release their shares to them at the end of each round, which would be the end of the year. He would value the company for them at the end of the year. And so then they understood how shares are released and how their value is impacted on a yearly basis. So the feedback we got from that was like, okay, that's great. Now apply it to Onyx. And so the next year, our CFO gave them decisions that were true decisions that we had to make as leaders within the company during that year. And why did we make those? So it's like, what are the decisions, and why is very important too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just incredible to see everybody like want to learn more about the business.
Amazing. It sounds almost like game theory. And let's see, as we play these different games, what the result is.
Yes.
So I like that concept quite a bit. What about growth? Is growth a requirement to make this all work? And a lot of manufacturing companies in this country are not growing, and they're stuck in a stable state. So talk about growth and any requirements there.
Yeah. So I don't know. Yes, growth is necessary, right? Otherwise, we'd just be going backwards.
Right.
But yeah, so for us to grow organically is somewhat hard, right? We're regionally based service contractor. We will travel nationally, like to some of our sister companies, clients' companies, but we have been adding personnel to help us grow in our field services. We are in a spot where, like, our clients, they need outsourced maintenance because they're not able to fulfill all the jobs in their plants. So they're using their personnel for production. So now we're in this growth opportunity of outsourced maintenance, but we too need the same people that they're looking for. We just have the advantage to be able to share them amongst a lot of clients. So developing those skills, all those trades, welding, bricklaying, laboring is really important for our organization. But also in the future, as an ESOP, we're going to have this cash when the sellers are paid out, right? When the bank debt's paid off, you're going to have this cash. We're going to need to think about how to strategically deploy that. And acquisitions are going to make a lot of sense in that realm. Yep. So we're already making hit list of what do we want to research so that we know when the time comes, when we're ready, these are the very specific things that we're going to look for. For an ESOP, what's really important in an acquisition is to not dilute the current shareholders. So some acquisitions won't make sense for us. If it's very heavy labor, low EBITDA, it's not going to make sense. So we're going to need something that's more service service related or more technology related.
Interesting. What will your role and Drew's role going forward look like in this company? You're a chairperson of a company that you have no ownership in the company at this point?
We have no ownership in the company.
Okay.
Drew and I sit on the board of directors for the company. So we still are there in an advisory standpoint. A very important topic of succession planning, right?
Yeah.
And transitioning to that next leadership group. So that's where we are right now. Our role as board members is more involved than you would think it would be just because we're in the previous owners and leaders.
I'm sure.
Transitioning. Yeah. So we have weekly operational calls with our new leadership, with the leaders, monthly financial calls, and then quarterly board meetings.
Okay.
And so eventually in the next year or so, we'll end up just being quarterly board meetings and on an as needed basis as that transition takes place. But
makes sense.
Right now we're fulfilling the, oh crap, this just happened. What do I do?
Right, I get it. And I assume that's a compensated position to be on the board, as it would have to be, because it's very involved. I think it's amazing. It's a great story. And more companies should hear about this story to inspire them to change. So this led you, this cultural transformation, which we didn't really talk a lot about, like what were the challenges in putting this cultural transformation in the organization, but I think you wrote about it in your book, Leading with Grit and Grace, A Journey of Organizational Culture Change. Tell us a little bit about the transformational story of Onyx and your book.
Yeah. So in 2020, my sister and my marketing coordinator asked me to write a book. September of 2020, we're all still shut down. And so I found myself with extra time. And I thought, gosh, I'm an engineer by schooling, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not always known for our our writing abilities.
Right.
You know, we're pretty direct and straightforward. So I thought, oh, I don't know. But I thought, if I do this, if I write this book, if one person reads it and it helps them know that there's light at the end of the tunnel, that'll be worth it. And so I'm probably at 3,000 books sold at this point, which isn't...
That's fantastic. No, it's not that easy to get a book sold. Trust me. I don't even know my current numbers, but it's not that easy. So that's good.
Yeah. It's been great. I've met people from across the country, across the world, say to me, oh my goodness, this piece resonated with me, or I'm going to try this idea out. And it's always a different idea or a different piece that resonated. And I think it was my journey. And I think people can see themselves in my journey, even though their journey is different than mine. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. Sure. Speaking from your experience is a very powerful teaching tool, and because you're sharing and no one can argue with what your experience. Was it difficult to change the culture at Onyx?
I think it took time. And then you're always met with resistance. You always have the people that like hop on board right away. And then you always have the ones that lag behind, if you can ever change them at all. But it took time. I will say one of the best quotes I ever heard, I think it was Steve Jobs, that says every overnight success is 10 years in the making.
Yeah. I think it was 25 actually, how I quote it, but yeah, it took a long time. So
it takes time. Yeah.
How clear were you that there needed to be a culture transformation, or was it just like gradually happening and then you were becoming aware, this is what's going on, this is what we're doing?
So I think it was more gradually happening. I think I was supposed to lead with a command and control leadership style, but it wasn't natural to me.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel good to me. Right. And so anytime I have that gut check, I'm like, I don't like that. Then I find another way. For instance, performance appraisals, yearly annual reviews, I got rid of them. I did a gut check. I thought, my managers hate doing them.
Right.
People hate having them done. They hate being rated, right?
Yep.
It creates chaos and turmoil in our organization. And I thought, why are we talking about the past? That's how we came to the coach approach. Why aren't we looking to the future? So just one of those examples of a gut check. And I just decided to do it differently.
I'm 100% in agreement with you. Talking to a client about that right now, because it's always pulling teeth, getting managers to do these performance reviews. Why not make them weekly or monthly? And in lieu of an annual sit down, grueling, let's review the past year, and we pull out my laundry list of things that you did right and wrong.
Yeah.
But weekly, give feedback. Just, we call them attaboys, right? But, or attagirls. But yeah, what did you do? Great. Super. So let's talk a little bit about your experience with boards of directors. You're now currently sitting on some different boards of directors, and your thoughts about when maybe a company should form one, or what's been your experience so far?
Yeah. So the first board that I sat on was Onyx's.
Okay.
And we formed it because we were in a period where we were in flux. We needed to make changes. And so we brought in experts who had the skill set that we knew we needed to make changes that we needed. So that's one reason to bring in a board, right? Whether
sure.
you're declining. The other reason is, so one of the boards I sit on, he explained it. He had been in peer group for many years. And he just said, I outgrew my peer group. He said, it was lonely at the top. It was tired of facing me in the mirror and asking questions. And he said, that's why I joined the peer group. But then I needed more specific advice for my company. He did an advisory board. So there are two different types of boards. A lot of business owners don't want a board because they don't want a board that can fire them.
Correct.
Right? So an advisory board is just that. You're an advisor. The fiduciary board does have the ability to fire the CEO.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to choose as the business owner. Set up an advisory board. They're there to help.
And so the board at Onyx, is that a fiduciary or non-fiduciary?
So this has to be a fiduciary board because we're an ESOP.
Of course.
Okay. So in the ESOP world, you do have to have a board of directors. You do have to have an independent board of director. And so I fulfill that role for several ESOPs across the country, but we have an independent at Onyx because Drew and I weren't able to make some decisions because we were wearing too many hats, right? Mm-hmm. We were the management team, and then we were the board. So yeah, the ESOPs have fiduciary boards.
And by the way, we didn't talk about replacing you and Drew in the roles that you were fulfilling at Onyx. Was that task number one was to replace Drew in the sales position and you in the CEO position?
Yeah. So we did. We replaced both sales and CEO. Drew within for the CEO and then stole back to one of our technical sales representatives. He'd worked for the company, he'd come up through the ranks, he'd gone and worked for another company, and we were able to bring him back aboard.
That's great. Awesome. So the boards, what's the balance or composition of the board? Do you find that you need a CPA and an attorney, as maybe an industry expert or two, a transformational expert? How many people? What's been your experience?
Yeah, so I think 3 to 5 members.
Okay, so small.
But we're dealing with smaller companies. We're not dealing with 500. So for these smaller family businesses, I would say my experience has been if you are somewhere less than 75 million in revenue, you have 3 members. And once you get over that 75 million, you're starting to look at 5. Odd is always good.
Of course.
You have the tiebreaker built in, right?
Yep.
My experience has not been to have like your CPA and your attorney on the board because they're already in an advisory capacity for your company. Right. So it's generally people who, like in my case, a lot of people hire me because I understand ESOP and I can understand the governance of ESOPs. So that's why they would put me on as an independent in some cases. Sometimes it's like a growth. Our next board member, I would look to have acquisition experience so that they can guide us in that realm. Yeah,
I wouldn't think the board would be that small, actually. I'm used to working with boards of directors in nonprofits. Some of them are quite large. We've had 12 to 16 members on a board, a loan board that was probably of similar size, a nonprofit board that was a conglomeration of several other nonprofits that had 75 members on the board. And there was maybe an executive committee of 7 or something like that. But yeah, interesting, because I would think a larger board, I'd have my accountant and my attorney and someone who is in the negotiation space, maybe an industry person who'd already exited their business. It's interesting that you're talking about such a small board.
Yeah, my experience with nonprofits is that they're much larger boards, but they're also not compensated. Right. So you're also talking about an expense to the company to compensate these board members. So
yes.
Small companies probably couldn't afford 17 board members.
Correct. Exactly. No, but maybe 5. Okay. I'll split the difference with you. All right. Any other thoughts you want to share? Maybe some of the more takeaways about your book and useful to the listener.
Yeah. So I think maybe my advice would be don't be afraid of establishing that board. I know a lot of small business owners, like I said, don't want to do it for whatever reason, but it really forces you to work on the business and not in the business because you are held accountable to called 4 quarterly board meetings. And you have to take that time to sit down and really think about the business and think about what's happening in the market. Think about how you grow or how you transition or succession. All those big topics that we put at the bottom of our to-do list, they're scary.
Ashley, a few unexpected questions here. Any favorite books or leaders or leadership books that inspired you along your path?
Yeah. So start with why.
Okay.
I think is really important, right? Because you have to know your purpose and your why, because that gives you the energy to lead through these transformations. Mm-hmm. So that one was very impactful. One of the ones I've read most recently that I absolutely love the idea of is called The Dream Manager, because in manufacturing, we struggle with hiring and retaining and recruiting. And a lot of production level, entry level jobs, they're just hard. They're hard on the body, they're hard on the mind, right? And this book talks about how you can help people fulfill their personal dreams. We always think about how can we give them a roadmap, a career, a development, right? But sometimes it's just about the personal needs and the person.
That sounds good. All right, next question is, what's one piece of advice you would give successors and family businesses if they want to be a disruptive successor?
Do a gut check. If it doesn't feel right, if it doesn't feel like you, don't continue doing it, right? So you're meant to be disruptive. What got you here won't get you there. So do that gut check and figure out your way. It's okay. Like in year one or whatever that time span is, like you can continue with the flow. But when something just doesn't feel right or there's a better way, don't be afraid to make it better.
Fantastic. How would you like people to connect with you if they're interested in learning more about what you do or how to get a hold of you?
Yeah. So LinkedIn is definitely probably the easiest way, right? But I also have a website. It's ashleywalters.co. And so you can jump out there. There's shoot me an email. There's resources out there for you as a person to grow or to help grow your team. They're free. I don't even ask you for an email. You download them, you use them. And if we can ever be of assistance, just reach out.
Great. So much like the title of your book, Leading with Grit and Grace, I'll have to pick up a copy myself. And it's been so enjoyable to have you on the show, sharing your wisdom, your experience, and wish you great luck in your future endeavors.
Thanks so much. It's been fun.
All right. So folks, you know the drill about sharing, about giving us a great rating. Also, what you need to think about is if your business might be a candidate for an ESOP, look at it as an alternative form of exiting your business. And if your business is ripe for some kind of organizational change or culture transformation, I think Ashley said it. So start with a gut check. Does it feel right? Is it a change that needs to be made? And then go forth and make it. So thanks for listening to our show. Stay tuned to future episodes. This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, The Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at thegoldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session. Thank you for joining us on the Disruptive Successor Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, review, and share with a friend who would benefit from the message. If you're interested in picking up a copy of my book, Disruptive Successor, go to disruptivesuccessor.com.